Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
Support for LAist comes from Visual Communications, presenting VC Film Fest, celebrating 40 years of Asian and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander filmmaking, with over 200 films May 1st through 10th. Info at festival.vcmedia.org.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us wherever you're listening, in Southern California, across the country, or worldwide, on the LAist app or at LAist.com. Speaking of LAist.com, I encourage you to sign up for the newsletter that we're doing every week now. It just debuted last week. It's Air Talk Weekly, in which I point you to some of the really interesting segments that we've done over the past week. We have links to them there, so if you miss them, it's really easy for you to catch up on what I think were some of our most interesting segments, and also to point to things we have coming up next week. For example, Monday on Earth Day, we have a program largely devoted to environmental issues and some really compelling, interesting topics. And I'll be sharing some of that with the newsletter that goes out tomorrow. So please subscribe today so that you get next week's edition of Air Talk Weekly. All you have to do, it's free, of course, is go to LAist.com/airtalk. And there you can see this little photo of me. You sign up with your email address, and then we confirm that, and we'll get it out to you every week in your email inbox, a chance for you to stay up to date and get some personal messages from me every week from Air Talk Weekly. Well, the University of Southern California has been roiled by the aftermath of the university's decision to cancel the commencement address by the valedictorian of USC, chosen by the administration, Asna Tabassum. She was planning to give the address at the commencement, which is a huge event. Tens of thousands of people attend. Of course, given the size of USC and the interest in the commencement, it's a big deal. She was chosen through a process where a committee is established by the university. It's not students who choose her, who chose her as the person that best exemplified the class to give the address. But what the university claimed is that they had a number of threats of violence that they took very seriously and felt, at least as they said, that they could not hold the commencement and guarantee the safety of those involved, including the valedictorian, if she was allowed to speak. Now, the threats were related to criticism that Tabassum received for posts and links to posts that she had in social media profile. They were pro-Palestinian, the ones that were criticized, and what some said were anti-Semitic commentary that were part of it. She is said she is by no means anti-Semitic and that her work against genocide crosses beyond just her concerns on behalf of Palestinians. I'd like to hear from you. If you're a part of the USC campus, you're a student, faculty member, administrator, staff member, you're part of the USC community, how have you seen this decision affecting life on campus? What is the mood of the student body and of the community as a whole? And what do you think has transpired in the time since? Now, we talked earlier this week with Air Talk listeners very generally your thoughts about the university making this decision. I'm really asking right now to confine the comments to those who are active members of the USC community. And that can be alums. If you have a sense of what's happening on campus and within the alumni community, if you're really plugged in, not just commenting as an alum with a point of view, but if you're really plugged into the community, that too would be fine for you to comment on this, what you perceive is the response within the SC community. 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. You can also email your comments if you'd prefer not being on the air and using your voice to share the comments. You can do it in an email at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. You can also post on our AirTalk page at las.com/airtalk. With me is Los Angeles Times national correspondent Javed Kalim, who has been writing about this, who interviewed valedictorian Asna Tabassum, and has also been talking with members of the USC community. Javed, thank you very much for being with us. So what's your sense of how this is affecting the SC community?
Thank you, Larry. Well, the intention USC had was to calm things down. They said they wanted to make the campus safer, and USC has been embroiled for months, like many colleges, over protest and controversy over the Israel-Hamas war and reactions here in the US. But instead of calming things down, things have gotten worse. This student, Asna Tabassum, went from being somebody that was known at USC for her achievements and for her Instagram link about Israel and Palestine to being somebody who's known nationally and internationally. We have Congress people tweeting about her now, and all eyes are on USC. And a lot of people I've talked to says basically, you know, there's no good way out of this situation.
As your Times colleague Jenny Jarvie wrote in a piece that was published early today, USC 5 months ago, citing safety as the rationale, banned economics professor John Strauss, who's Jewish, from coming onto campus and speaking after student activists say they felt threatened when he approached them at a protest and said Hamas are murderers. I hope they all are killed. USC spokesperson at the time said our North Star is protecting the safety of our community. That, too, roiled the community 5 months ago. And now we've got this incident with the valedictorian. Wouldn't be surprising to see protests at the commencement address from people who aren't happy one way or the other on this. In your conversation with students and your colleagues' conversations with student Javed, what did they say about their reaction? Were there some who supported the university? And I'm sure there were those who were highly critical of the university's cancellation.
We found that the criticism is very prevalent. Part of it stems from the university being so vague about the reasons why it canceled this speech. And they're citing this, they cite safety precautions, but they've refused to explain what threats there are beyond that, related to the student or her speech, or who they're coming from or by what means they are. So that leaves people to speculate. So there was a backlash against the student, not for anything she said or did in regards to pro-Palestinian activism, but for a link on her Instagram page that had statements that many Jewish people found offensive regarding Israel. But she's still valedictorian. So some folks I've spoken to said, you know, that it's odd to have her not speak, but still recognize her as a university with its top student position. Others have said she's being silenced and pointed out that she wears the hijab and is a Muslim woman who studies genocide as her minor, and they feel she's being targeted. Tabassum has told me that herself as well.
I've targeted by those critical of her comment, because the university are the ones who chose her. So clearly the university didn't have a problem with her faith or wearing the hijab in the choice of her. But are they saying the critics of her have targeted her for that reason?
The university did choose her as the valedictorian, and then they also chose after that to cancel her speech. So I think, you know, they're not answering about the discrepancy there and what diligence they did in their research prior and what their qualifications in this volatile year of protest, if they were different at all for this position. But they do say they're not targeting political speech, although, you know, this is a political issue by its nature. So there's some things that don't line up and match there. I'll tell you, I spoke to some Jewish community members, and even Jewish community members who, such as the Chabad on campus, or looking at a group called Trojans for Israel, or the Hillel community on campus. Many folks there who have been critical of this selection of valedictorian and agree that she should not speak because they feel she doesn't represent the right values for USC. Even these Jewish communities have been critical of USC for what they've done because they believe there is an issue about anti-Semitism that is being unaddressed, and that the university is just focusing on questions of security. So Jewish individuals I spoke to the rabbi who leads Chabad at USC, which does outreach for thousands of students and graduates there. He told me, Dov Wagner, he said, there's no good way out of this, and that he wishes USC would use this as a chance to talk about free speech, talk about anti-Semitism, to talk and have a dialogue, instead of just having this controversy get bigger and bigger. Today there's a protest on campus, so we'll see what happens.
And has the university reported any of the threats that they said they received to law enforcement, to the LAPD, or to the campus police department?
We have, the campus police department releases a daily log of incidents and such. There has not been one, as far as I can tell, directly related to commencements that they've reported publicly. We did reach out to LAPD asking if they've heard from USC about threats about commencement or this commencement speaker or valedictorian. LAPD told us they have not received any information on this, and USC will not answer questions. I personally have asked them many times about what the threat is, or of what nature, or against whom, or what size, and they will not answer questions about that.
We're talking with Los Angeles Times national correspondent Javid Kalim. He has been closely covering this story for the past several days after USC canceled the valedictory address by graduating senior Asna Tabassum. She had been chosen by the administration. She met the criteria, the minimum criteria for the very high GPA for any applicant, a couple hundred people, according to the university had applied. About 100 people ended up being interviewed and vetted for the position. She was the one who was chosen of all of the graduating seniors to give that address. But after criticism of her social media comments and likes and what the university said were threats, that speech was canceled. The university, as Javed just said, claimed that this was not about the content of anything she was going to say or about who she is as a person or her political views, but because of the threats that they therefore were canceling the address. If you're part of the USC community, I'd like to hear from you how you see this playing out. How has it affected the campus? I know 5 months ago that there was tremendous controversy that followed the ban on economics professor John Strauss being kept off of campus after student activists say they felt threatened by him for a verbal encounter that he had with pro-Palestinian protesters on campus. We're at 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@las.com. I'd like to hear from you if you are in any way directly and significantly connected to the USC community. You spend time on campus. You have a sense of what's happening among groups of students, professors, the administrators on campus, other staff members, alumni who are connected closely with other SC alumni, how this conversation is playing out. James in North Hollywood says, I think the real issue could be that big donors are threatening to pull funding if she's allowed to speak. And at the end of the day, the money is what this is about. We don't have any evidence for that contention, do we, Javed?
No, we have no evidence for that. Certainly, USC has a variety of donors and of different political views and backgrounds. So I'm sure some may be unhappy or happy depending upon their perspective with the news, but we have no evidence of that being the reason why.
Or of any organizing on the part of major donors to try and stop the address from being given. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. We're keeping you updated on this issue to affect the campus. Javed, I mentioned earlier that there are likely going to be protests. There might have been protests at commencement anyway, just because of the very polarized political times that we're in, and that's a very large-scale, high-profile event. But have you heard from particular groups that have said they are going to use the occasion of commencement to protest?
On commencement, USC is very accustomed to dealing with security issues. It's the main commencement, 65,000 people at the very least. And last year the Obama family was there, so they're used to high profile situations. Regarding this year's commencement, I have heard a little bit about some students who might do a protest in one form or another. But again, this is not unusual prior to this news of the cancellation of the speech. Graduations, especially in years of political upheaval and war, tend to have protests and statements that happen or expressions that students make. So I can only imagine that that was going to happen anyway, and there might be more of it now.
I'm thinking about the president of Warner Discovery, I believe it was, at Boston University, and there's a big protest of students there over him speaking. And yeah, I mean, this has become, as you say, pretty common event for particularly the large scale commencement graduation events. Javed, thank you very much for being with us and sharing with us the latest. We appreciate it very much. Good chance to catch up on what's happening at USC on this. Thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate your ongoing coverage of the story.
Thank you so much.
That's Javed Kalim, Los Angeles Times national correspondent. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. So good to have you with us. Owen emailed, "I think more questions need to be asked about how the valedictorian was chosen. Sounds like an internal power struggle between the upper house of the administration, which includes donors, and the lower house, which includes a broader range of faculty and administrators at the various schools." It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. John in Raleigh, North Carolina says, "I think SC should have allowed the valedictorian to give the speech." Coming up, we'll talk about a turn of the 20th century plan to create a bikeway from Pasadena to downtown Los Angeles to make people's commute all the better. This was before the automobile came to rule Southern California. We'll talk with our LA Explained reporter for LAist, Caitlin Hernandez, about what this great bikeway was all about. California Cycleway, its short history, when we come back in just 1 minute.
Support for LAist comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting the world premiere of Ghost Waltz by Oliver Mayer, a bold original recovery of Juventino Rosas, one of Mexico's most significant composers. Follow Rosas from his father's early death to his friendship with ragtime genius Scott Joplin, now on stage through June 2nd. Tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
I know it's not Monday when we typically do Southern California history, but there's so many great history stories for us to cover. We can do it other days too, and that's exactly what we're doing, involving a new story by LAist Caitlin Hernandez. Their piece is titled, "LA Once Had a Bicycle Freeway, What Happened to 1900 Cyclist Dream?" Caitlin, good to have you with us.
good to talk to you too, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
So let's talk about this turn of the 20th century California cycleway, which went right by our studios here at LAist in Pasadena. Who was behind this idea?
Yes. So it was, like most LA history goes, it was a big millionaire who had money to spend. It was Horace Dobbins, who ended up being a mayor of Pasadena at one point. He kind of had this big dream to connect Pasadena and downtown LA specifically to each other. Both communities had a big bike population of riders, so there was a lot of incentive there for sure.
It began at the Hotel Green, which is a beautiful structure, still there, much of it, in Pasadena, comprising the Castle Green, as it's now called, which is a co-op building, and the Hotel Green property adjacent to it. They were developed at different times, and the hotel actually extended with a bridge over Raymond Avenue, just north of our studios, where there was yet another annex of the hotel along the east side of Raymond Avenue. So it was quite a complex. At 1900, Dobbins had this idea. And how much of it was constructed, Caitlin?
You know, not too much. The cycleway, the California cycleway it was called, was originally slated to be a 9-mile route. But because of, it could be the expenses of it all or the how interest dropped, it ended up only reaching about like a mile and a mile and 0.3 all the way just to Raymond Hill. So I don't think it even officially left Pasadena.
I don't think so.
Yeah. But so it didn't reach too far, unfortunately.
Next, California Governor Henry Harrison Markham was part of this. And so how many people used it in this less than a year period that the cycleway was formally open?
Great question. So, you know, we don't really have solid numbers on how many, you know, riders actually went on it. From what I, read about and learned, there was some early interest and it did do pretty well when it first opened on New Year's Day in 1900. But, you know, through the course of a really brief, I think it was 11 months or so, or just till October of that year, that same year, it didn't, really pick up steam after that. It slowed down, I think, partly because of, it didn't reach the full route it was intended to. So there was little need for, people in Pasadena to hop on this, bicycle freeway, so to speak, and go all the way just to Raymond Hill.
Cycleway to nowhere, exactly. Well, the other side of it is, the idea, as I understand it, as you wrote in your piece, Caitlin, was that you could coast all the way to downtown Los Angeles. You could coast essentially to the foot of Raymond Hill for the portion that was built, but then you've got to ride back up. So if you're doing it for a pleasure ride, it's not really level ground.
Definitely. Yeah. So, I mean, it at some cases it raised up to like 50 feet high, and other places it was just a few feet off the ground. So it definitely did vary. And yeah, the idea was, I think Pasadena is a little bit more elevated than downtown LA, that you just kind of roll on down without having to even like put your foot to the pedal. But of course, returning would be a little bit more of an exercise routine for sure.
Yeah. I was going to say the ride home then would be the rough one when you're riding all that, 9 miles. Had they built it that far, that 9 miles uphill. What construction materials were used for the cycleway?
It's actually pretty fascinating. I think now we think of things of being like hard steel and concrete and all that, but this was made out of wood. And there was some barriers that had some type of metal in them on the edges, but the construction itself, like what people's tires rode on, was just wood. And it was shipped over some special kind of bark that they used. And it was, pretty basic construction, just a platform to ride on.
And amazingly, in its short life, it didn't burn, because so many wooden things at that time, the turn of the 20th century, were highly vulnerable to fire. What happened once Dobbins decided he wasn't going to operate it anymore, they weren't going to collect the tolls? What happened to the cycleway?
Right. So, as I said, it was in October of that same year of 1900 that they ended up basically stopping construction. Dobbins' company announced that they were suspending it. And so pretty much through the years, it was kind of in this quasi area where Dobbins still had his right of way and the cycle way was still physically there, but no one was really using it. There wasn't really anything happening with the space. So a lot of, you know, Pasadena residents especially kind of spoke up and they're like, this is an eyesore. We want to get this removed. Nobody's using it and things like that. So I think it was in 1907, the cycle way was actually listed. I want to say the materials that made the cycle way, the bridge, was listed for sale. So people could buy the materials. And then, you know, the right of way, which is that route between Pasadena and downtown LA, ended up being sold off. And now we have the 110. That's pretty much where most of that used to be.
It's funny. Yeah, of course. And that became the first freeway in America. And all the twists and turns, which are still on that freeway, because at that time they didn't plow right through straight ahead and just cut the path. They followed the Arroyo Seco waterway and the hills. And so you get, you know, what's that beautiful curve of the Pasadena Freeway? Some people don't think it's beautiful. I do. Between Pasadena and downtown Los Angeles. I love hearing this story, Caitlin, because it really speaks to, you know, the sort of can-do attitude that so many people had in that era as technology is making, you know, such advances with the automobile coming on the scene and technology really making leaps and bounds in a short period of time. And there were so many moneyed people who had these ideas that they could revolutionize something, including transportation. And this is a great example of that, I think.
Definitely. You know, and I think in these days, the cycleway was really hailed as a marvel of what design could be for future travel. So he definitely inspired a lot, I think, with our freeways.
You say in your piece that the estimated price tag in $1,900, $187,500, that would be $7 million today. That's to build the whole, the 9 miles of it, correct?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, yeah. That was for the whole thing. Caitlin, thank you so much. Really appreciate you talking about your piece at LAist.com. I encourage people to read it, and great photos, of course, of what it looked like at the turn of the 20th century. Caitlin Hernandez, LA Explained reporter for LAist. Make sure you read their piece at LAist.com. It's Air Talk on 89.3. And so glad you could join us as we continue. Right after the break, we'll take a look at the legal issues over frozen embryos. Many couples who have the means to do so choose this as a way of delaying having children, but making sure that the odds are better that they will be able to have a child later on. But what happens when the couple splits? That's led to some very high-profile disagreements. We'll take that on when we come back in just 1 minute.
Support for LAist comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting American Mariachi by Jose Cruz Gonzalez. It's the 1970s and women can't be mariachis. Or can they? American Mariachi is a feel-good comedy about familia, amor, and tradición that will send your heart soaring and put a bounce in your step with a wave of vibrant, infectious live music. On stage through June 9th, tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
So good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. You know, many couples are opting to delay having kids, and there have been a number of medical advances to provide for that opportunity in a delayed manner. A person can freeze eggs or freeze sperm. You can also create embryos through in vitro fertilization, where an embryo is created in the laboratory using an egg and sperm. And some couples have decided to freeze their embryos. But then what happens when there's a disagreement with the couple later on, or the couple splits? What then happens to those frozen embryos? Joining us to talk about that challenge is reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist at California Fertility Partners, Dr. Kelly Beck. Dr. Beck, good to have you with us today.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
How common is this procedure to have a fertilized egg that creates an embryo frozen?
So nowadays, most couples or patients are choosing to freeze embryos because they want to genetically screen the embryo. We can't do that with a fresh transfer. So 99.9% of my patients are freezing embryos. So they fertilize the egg with sperm, grow them out for 5 to 7 days, biopsy, freeze, and genetically screen so we know whether or not that an embryo is genetically normal. And we check for the 23 pairs of chromosomes.
I was reading that insurance will often more readily cover freezing of embryos than for freezing of eggs and sperm. Is that correct?
It's really dependent on which insurance policy and which group that you're working with. So some insurance policies based on your patient's history, it is true that they will freeze eggs and sperm less readily than embryos, because with embryos, there's a higher chance of a live birth because we know that the egg fertilized properly has grown out to a day 5 embryo and is genetically normal. Whereas with frozen eggs, it's just a potential. We don't know how they will thaw, if they will fertilize, and if there is a normal embryo in that cohort of eggs.
And what sorts of agreements, if any, do you have your patients sign about the custody of the embryos should the couple disagree on implantation or the couple break up and decide, that they're not both going to move forward with having the child?
Sure. So that for in our practice, we're a medical practice. So we only have the consent forms for the medical procedure itself. If a couple is married, then we will follow whatever the divorce decree dictates. If we have an unmarried couple, then what I recommend, or if it's two friends who want to create an embryo together, I always recommend they meet with a reproductive attorney to create a reproductive contract prior to any embryo being created. Therefore, they know ahead of time what will happen to those embryos should the relationship dissolve.
Where are the frozen embryos typically stored? Are there specific facilities that do just that?
Yeah, so if it's for a short term, most patients opt to keep the embryos frozen on site at our center. However, if they don't plan on using the embryos for years, they will oftentimes move them off site. And there are centers that will just keep the frozen embryos for long term. And so you can choose that at specific privately owned sperm banks. They also offer embryo freezing storage, as well as other private companies that will keep frozen embryos.
I'd love to hear from AirTalk listeners if you've gone through this process and having an embryo frozen, whether there's been any conflict, maybe you and your partner or spouse, not sure exactly when you want to move forward with trying to have a child. I'd be interested in hearing sort of what this was like for you. What decisions went into it? Did you have a legal agreement with your partner, with your spouse, or with your friend about this, on how you would be handling the frozen embryo should there be discord or breakup that happens in the relationship? We're at 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. We're talking with Dr. Kelly Beck, who's reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist at California Fertility Partners. Speaking of a legal expert in this area of fertility, we're joined by Lori Myers, partner of International Fertility Law Group. She's been practicing reproductive/fertility law for more than 25 years in Los Angeles. Lori, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it very much. How much has your the part of your practice increase dealing with frozen embryos?
Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here this morning and join this conversation with Dr. Beck. I have really seen the increase in this field, the growth in this field, based on the medical success of the technology over the years. You know, the process works. And Dr. Beck this morning has already expressed, you know, what the medical technology can do in terms of an optimal result, getting that higher chance of success, what the medicine can prove as far as a quality embryo, the storage and formation of those embryos, and the forms that are signed at the very beginning really create that ownership and control of the embryo throughout the process of these treatments. So the field has expanded in large part based on the success of the medical technologies.
And what are the things that you counsel clients, or, you know, even your dinner party and people ask you about, you know, well, what should people keep in mind in this? What is your general advice about how to talk with the person who you're combining sperm and egg with to create the embryo in advance of that procedure?
I think it's really hard to ask the difficult questions so early in the process when, just by virtue of meeting with a specialist like Dr. Beck, you've already gone through so much. You're trying so hard to create a child. The last thing on your mind is what happens if you're breaking up because you're trying so hard to form your family. It's such a personal and emotional decision, and yet you have to think about the what ifs so that everybody's rights are protected, so that you're on the same page, so that that worst case scenario never happens. I often say that going through the legal process serves as a checklist of all the things to consider. And some people just, you know, they talk to me and they think, oh, do we have to put something in there about what happens if we break up? But you really do. You have to be forward thinking so that everyone's intentions are memorialized and rights are protected.
It reminds me of the emotions that are raised around prenuptial agreements before couples marry. And you know, the idea is, well, if you do break up, it's actually going to make it easier because you've already had a financial agreement of sorts that before you even started your marriage together. And this similarly seems like you're going against that emotion, like, you know, I don't want to think about this. That's not something I want to even, you know, there's some people who feel like, well, you potentially bring it on yourself if you even give space to that sort of a thought. And I assume, Ms. Myers, you come up against that.
I think that's right. That's exactly right. You know, people just don't want to think about it. It seems like it puts the wrong energy into the joy of trying to kind of be forward thinking about the growth of a family rather than pulling it apart. But again, you know, because of even the storage that was just mentioned, what if the embryos moved off site? What you sign on those initial consent forms, the agreements that are signed at the beginning, are going to follow you through the entire process so that if it's at a different facility, those permissions are going to become more and more important as the years go by.
Again, I'd love to hear from AirTalk listeners. If you've gone through this process of having you and your partner's embryo frozen, and what sorts of, if any, legal agreements did you make going into that? What sort of understanding did you have with your partner, spouse, or friend about this process and what the custody would be if there was a breakup? To what extent did you address that? We're at 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. You can also comment on our AirTalk page at las.com/AirTalk. Lori Myers, are there state laws that come into play here, and are they significantly different state to state?
Yes, these are things that are regulated by individual states. This was something that was sort of brought to national attention recently with that really difficult case out of Alabama. That case involved a wrongful death suit where, after a mishap in the lab, and the loss of embryos, those embryos were actually given personhood status. So, in that state, not only are you considering the possibility that a couple would break up and have different interests and rights in conflict between each other, now the embryos themselves have rights. And so each state is definitely different in these times. And California has long been the leader with respect to reproductive rights. And so these protections are more solidly in place in a state like California versus other states throughout the country.
What does California law indicate, if it does, about custody of frozen embryo if there is disagreement between the couple or if the relationship's broken up and you have one of the exes who wants to see the child born from that frozen embryo? How does California handle that?
That's a great question. And I think what's important is it has less to do with the marital status of the couple and more about the ownership interest in creating the embryos from the start. So California would follow almost like a property model, an ownership model, so that once you contribute your genetic material or sign an agreement in the formation of embryos, sometimes donors are utilized. The clinic will actually tag those embryos that those people own and control the embryos. And those documents then follow the embryo throughout the process so that if it's moved to another place and you signed the initial consent forms individually or as a couple, those individuals and couples that legally then own and control the embryos are responsible mutually in making those decisions.
Does that mean both need to be on board to move forward with implantation of the embryo?
That's correct.
Okay. So if only one approves, it's not going to go forward.
That's correct. And that's how you have seen in the news, litigation and conflict when maybe a woman whose fertility is, she's losing her fertility as she's reaching into her 40s. Someone that created embryos with a partner in her 30s, not thinking that they might break up, wanting to use them, that maybe that's her last chance. The clinic will not legally be able to release the embryos only to her without the permission of the spouse that created, or the partner, or the friend that legally put that in place at the beginning of the formation of the embryo.
We're talking with fertility law expert Lori Myers, the attorney's partner with International Fertility Law Group. She's been practicing reproductive and fertility law for more than 25 years here in Los Angeles. We're also talking with reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist at the California Fertility Partners, Dr. Kelly Beck. If you have questions for them about how the law considers frozen embryos when disputes over those embryos take place, we're at 866. 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. You can email us at atcomments@las.com or comment on our AirTalk page at las.com/AirTalk. We'll be back in just 1 minute. What happens with frozen embryos when the two contributors to the creation of the embryo disagree about whether to move forward with implantation of the embryo? This is an issue that's come to the fore in some very high-profile disputes involving Hollywood celebrities and others, where one of the two people involved has wanted to control what's done with the frozen embryo. So I'm interested in hearing from you if you're someone who's gone through this fertility process, had an embryo frozen, What were some of the agreements, if any, that you had with your partner or your spouse? How did you deal with this? Was there any conflict about the timing of this or otherwise, or what would happen with the frozen embryo? Please share with us what sorts of process you were involved with at 866-893-5722. Dr. Kelly Beck of California Fertility Partners, has your practice been at all, even tangentially, involved in one of these disputes over frozen embryos?
We have, but the biggest concern that we have at times are when someone agrees to be a known egg donor or a known sperm donor for a friend. So they sign all the documents relinquishing any future rights to the embryo. And so, Lori, I'm sure you can discuss this, but we've had situations where we have someone who has donated to a friend and been designated a known sperm or an egg donor. And once a child is born, now falls in love with this child and wants custody rights. And that becomes a little messier. But in California, you've seen cases like this appear. And unfortunately, this is something where it goes back to the laws. And so we have seen both types of cases where it's when a couple dissolves or friends dissolve and they change, or when someone who was designated a known sperm or egg donor changed their mind about their status and want to change it after an embryo is created.
Yeah, and Lori Myers, can you talk about the legal issues that then come into play?
I think that's a great example of a practical situation that happens, because sometimes couples that aren't married, maybe the relationship isn't working, they're splitting up, but you know, they'll say, okay, well, I'll be a donor to you. I'll help you form these embryos. I know you really want to be a parent. It's okay. And people enter into these contracts trying to sort of protect the financial interests of both sides, trying to protect legal rights. And then the child is born. And if they fall in love with the child, if the couple gets back together, then what we've done is we've got a donor contract, but in practical reality, the lines are blurred. It sort of become gray. And the law will actually recognize that grayness, that relationship. Over about a two-year period, a court will look at the relationship between parents and a child. And if practically you have held the child out as your own, over a period of years, it would take a period of years to establish this, parental rights could be granted. So again, it's really important to understand what your rights and responsibilities are and what kind of protections are in place.
Lori, when we're talking about just sperm alone or egg alone, is the law really clear on that, that the individual donor has in perpetuity custody of that, the frozen sperm or egg?
Are you talking about the recipient, not the donor would have control?
Well, before it's used in IVF. So it's just the sperm and egg as individual are frozen before anything else happens.
I do think there's a misnomer kind of in the general public that by virtue of simply having a genetic connection, that somehow the genetic connection will continue, or that once you sign this, that's it. And it's my exclusive right forever. There are very important distinctions that go into the formation of embryos and these legalities. And it's not always using the embryo later. Sometimes it's how to discard unused embryos mm-hmm. later. Who has control over that decision? Maybe when fertility treatment is done, maybe they've broken up and someone wants to donate it to medical research or simply allow it to thaw and destroy. You know, those are some of the agreements that are put into these contracts, the what ifs of it all. And at that point, it's not just based on the genetic connection. It has to do with what was signed, what was agreed, what were the boxes that were checked on the informed consent forms, and what were the behaviors going forward in terms of the relationship to a future child.
We're talking with attorney Lori Myers, partner in International Fertility Law Group, where she's been practicing reproductive and fertility law for more than 25 years, and Dr. Kelly Beck, reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist at California Fertility Partners. In closing, Dr. Beck, have these high-profile cases where there have been disputes about custody and use of frozen embryos led your patients to maybe talk about this more, to take more seriously the fact that there can be conflict later?
So, just to clarify, are you asking if they are trying to educate others to take this more seriously?
No, I'm just asking, are they raising some of these issues with you, or is it your sense they're dealing with some of these potential problems down the road up front because they've seen conflict happen in other cases over the future of frozen embryos?
Absolutely. At the initial consult, I really try to go through all the different permutations of things that could happen in the future. And we have this pretty strong discussion about why I'm recommending they consider meeting with a reproductive attorney who specializes in fertility and all the nuances of fertility and the state-to-state differences.
Right.
Because oftentimes patients will say, well, you know, I'm an attorney, can I just do it myself? And I really advise against it, and specifically why. So, you know, I refer to Lori's practice, who's amazing. And, you know, it's really important for patients to understand like the nuances. So even though I can introduce the initial issues or potential issues for the future, it's really hard because that's the last thing they want to hear or think about when they're so excited about creating an embryo for the future.
Thank you so much, Dr. Beck. Ms. Myers, we thank you both very much for being with us on Air Talk today. We have breaking news. The guitar legend Dickie Betts, who co-founded the Allman Brothers Band and wrote their biggest hit, Ramblin' Man, has died. He was 80 years of age. The Rock and Roll Hall of Famer died at his home in Osprey, Florida. Betts' manager of 20 years confirmed Betts had been battling cancer for more than a year and had COPD. Guitar legend Dickie Betts has died at the age of 80, wrote this song and shared lead guitar duties with Duane Allman in the original Allman Brothers Band. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3.
Support for LAist comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting the world premiere of Mix Mix, the Filipino Adventures of a German Jewish Boy by Boney B. Alvarez. Inspired by true events from the life of Ralph Price, after escaping Nazi Germany, a newfound tropical refuge in the Philippines is upended when Japan invades the islands. On stage through June 16th. Tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. It's Entertainment Thursday throughout the day on LAist 89.3 and LAist.com. And in that vein, coming up later this hour, it's TV Talk. Our critics will be telling us about a number of new and returning series, so make sure you stay tuned for that. If you're a regular listener to Air Talk, if you read LAist.com regularly, you know the outcome. outstanding work that our reporter Nick Goethe has been doing, covering the controversy surrounding an Orange County nonprofit that received millions of dollars in funding from the county, part of the approval process, including the Orange County supervisor, Andrew Doe, whose daughter Rhiannon has been listed as a top executive for that nonprofit. Our Nick Goethe, who is LAist senior reporter, joins us to talk about the latest development. Nick, thanks so much for being with us, and congratulations on being father to your second child recently born. That's wonderful.
Thanks so much, Larry. Appreciate that.
So what's the new development, particularly involving Rhiannon Doe?
Yeah, so the latest development is Rhiannon, who's the daughter of Supervisor Andrew Doe, who directed most of the meals money to this nonprofit, outside of public view, I should add, outside of public meeting agendas. She's now speaking for the first time in a series of a couple of emails to me earlier this month. She's adding her voice into the mix, and she made a series of claims that are in conflict with some of the documents. And basically, what she's saying is that she was not in these top leadership roles that are in the she's documented as being in, that she was not an officer or director of the nonprofit, which was Viet America Society is the name of the nonprofit group, and that she was not involved with the meals money funded by COVID dollars, federal COVID dollars, that's at the center of the most scrutiny right now about where those dollars went. But when I asked her about the public records, including some contracts that she signed in which she's disclosed as the president of this group and other documents she's disclosed as a director or officer of the group, on the board of directors of the group, I asked her, how does she explain these documents that show otherwise to what she's saying? And she would not answer those. She has not answered those questions. So it's still an open question of why she was marked as all of these leadership roles if she now says she was not in those roles. So a lot of open questions still. I'll add that the county is still searching for answers about where these millions of dollars went. Right now, the county's focusing on the first $2 or $3 million in meals funding that went directly to this group. This is back in 2021 and the first half of 2022. The county said that this group has failed to provide the required documentation accounting for where those dollars went, how many people actually received the meals. This money was required to be going, all of it, to be going towards feeding needy people during the pandemic.
These were federal dollars, but the county was responsible for doling them out.
Right. The vast majority of it was federal dollars that the county was responsible for doling out. And Supervisor Doe in particular was the one who directed these dollars to this nonprofit group that his daughter has been documented in these leadership roles for. And he did that in a process, most of that in a process outside of public view, with no public agenda disclosures, no opportunity for public comment, and without disclosing his close family relationship to this documented leader of this group, including not telling apparently the county CEO most of his colleagues on the Board of Supervisors.
Which, again, is not a formal requirement because it's an adult child, which the law, as you've reported, doesn't cover that, but raises a number of serious ethical questions about him doing it. Was he the sole decider on these funds being allocated to Viet America Society, or were there others who also had to vote on this allocation?
Yeah, so it depends on which bucket of money we're talking about. The first $2.2 million in meals funding that went to the group, he did decide completely on his own, outside of public view. And then there was an additional $2 million that he recommended go to them that the full board voted on. And usually the way it works at the Board of Supervisors is when a supervisor is proposing something for their district, the other board members pretty much automatically support it, unless there's some reason not to. So the board did kind of stamp that their approval on his recommendation for the additional that additional $2 million. And then subsequent to that, in 2023, Supervisor Doe directed an additional over $5 million in meal funding to this group his daughter was marked as leading. And that $5 million was completely outside of public view. So it's in total over $7 million in meals funding he directed outside of public view, another $2 million that was made the recommendation, and then the rest of the board gave their approval to.
And have you been able to determine what, if any, compensation Rhiannon Doe received for the work that she did with this organization?
Yeah, that's been murky to try and figure out. We've been asking. I did ask Rhiannon how much she was making from this group. She did not answer that question. The lawyer claimed she was only making $18,000 a year. That's the number that was disclosed for her compensation in 2022 on their public tax form. But we don't have a public tax form for them for 2023. We don't have a whole lot of documentation of how much she was making in 2023. But what we are seeing in some of the billings, the limited set of billings that we have been able to see, is that her compensation was in the thousands of dollars per month at a time when she was a full-time law student and has been a full-time law student at UC Irvine, which is supposed to limit how many outside hours she's working. So we're still piecing that together, but it's still unclear how much she was making, and she hasn't answered that question.
Did she say why she reached out to you in an email?
So this was in response. She was responding to an email I had sent, asking some pointed questions about money flows through this nonprofit to a company private company that she was involved in, and some other questions for some future reporting that we'll be fleshing out and reporting out later. But she was responding to very specific questions we had about these money flows and where it was going and her role leading this group. What we've reported out in this latest story is her answers about her leadership role in particular.
We're talking with LA's senior reporter Nick Gerda. Nick, Viet America Society, what activities were they engaged with prior to the COVID dollars being delivered to them? Is it mainly providing meals or other services?
Yeah, so from the documents, it appears they did not have any activities as a nonprofit before the COVID dollars started coming to them. They were created in June, July of 2020, according to their IRS filings, incorporated as an organization, nonprofit organization, and that was around the time that it appears the initial COVID dollars for meals that Supervisor Doe was directing for his district were being routed to Viet America Society through a different nonprofit called Hand to Hand Relief Organization. That's also under scrutiny from the county for a lack of documentation about where those dollars, what ultimately came of those dollars. So anyways, they were started around the same time they were getting COVID dollars. It appears all if not nearly all of their funding in their first year or two was from the county's direction of COVID dollars to them for meals. And they had some additional activities over the years around events in Supervisor Doe's district that he's invited them to host, like the Tet Festival, a major event in his district in Little Saigon, as well as a lunar moon festival. So there was, in the 10, $20,000 of sponsorships they were getting for those. But it's a comparatively small amount compared to the meals funding, which was in the millions. And they also got some funding that Doe directed to them for building a Vietnam War memorial at Miles Square Park, and additional funding Supervisor Doe was involved in approving to them around mental health services, including running the county's emotional support hotline in Vietnamese, which Viet America Society was actually suspended from being able to work on a couple months ago because they suddenly, this came right after they suddenly told their employees the entire organization was shutting down, and the nonprofit that manages the overall hotline ended up suspending them from their work, and that suspension is still in effect. And they say that nonprofit, NAMI Orange County, tells me they've been trying to meet with Viet America Society and have not gotten a response from them.
Nick, there's so many complexities to this story. I'm so impressed. You're not even referring to notes. That's how immersed you've been in this. This is very impressive, your degree of memory about all these details. And I mean, so many of these different aspects of it end in the same thing. The county is investigating. The county hasn't gotten answers. The county has set a deadline, and the organization has not delivered on what the county deadline was. What recourse does the county have if they don't get that information?
Yeah, so ultimately, the county has the option, and it would be up to the Board of Supervisors, which includes Supervisor Doe. He's one of the five county supervisors. It'd be up to a majority of the board to decide whether to take the ultimate step of suing the organization, taking them to court, and to require repayment of the money. And the county hinted at that in their demand letters back in February to this organization, to Vietnam America Society, in which they said that these documents have not been provided. They set a deadline of mid-March and said that the county reserves the right to require repayment of these dollars. But the typical county process is they allow lots of opportunities for their contractors to provide the documents even past deadlines. So the county did grant an extension of the deadline. A lot of the documents are now due this coming Wednesday at 5 p.m. But ultimately, if the county's not getting the documents they're requiring and they've given these chances, it's possible that the county staff will ask the board if they want to file a lawsuit. And interestingly, Supervisor Doe's wife is the assistant presiding judge of Orange County Superior Court. So there was a case back in November where a mistrial was declared because Supervisor Doe was a witness and it wasn't disclosed that he was married to the assistant presiding judge, a very senior judge in this court. And the judge in that trial throughout the entire trial and sent it to L.A. County Superior Court. So there's some indications that the Orange County courts may be uncomfortable or find they have a conflict or unable to handle cases that involve Supervisor Doe or his immediate family because of that.
And we should mention Supervisor Doe's term comes to an end. Couldn't run for re-election. He's termed out, so it comes to an end this year. If Viet America Society, though, doesn't exist, because didn't you say that they were winding down operations?
The hotlines, the nonprofit that oversees the overall hotline, NAMI Orange County, explained is that they got information from an employee at Viet America Society that the management had informed the staff that they were shutting down and everyone was being laid off. But that apparently was reversed a few days later, and the organization appears to still be operating, but they are no longer doing their mental health work. They were suspended from that work both by NAMI Orange County and by the only other county-funded mental health work they were doing, which was through an organization called OCAPICA. They've been cut off. Although, actually, I should say the OCAPICA mental health work was terminated in February, but it takes effect sometime between May and June. So there's sort of a wind down that's going on of that work.
Boy, there's no way you could have known when you started looking at this, all the complexities that would arise, the twists and turns that this case would take. I know in the immediate aftermath of your initial reporting, there were questions as to whether the supervisors were going to come up with a more robust ethics protocol to deal with circumstances like this, but that didn't really go anywhere, did it?
No, it was a very contentious policy debate that played out publicly. Supervisor Vicente Sarmiento, who represents Santa Ana, which was the area, Supervisor Doe used to represent Santa Ana, and now it's Sarmiento after redistricting, he had proposed a series of ethics reforms that would now do a number of things. It would have required supervisors disclose if they're awarding money to their immediate family members or organizations that involve their immediate family members. And it would also require more transparency about the COVID dollars and these district, quote unquote, district discretionary funding, which has been allowing supervisors to direct millions of dollars in their district, tax dollars in their district, outside of public view, outside of agenda disclosure. And by themselves, right, which is what Doe was using to direct many millions of these dollars to this organization. And it came up for a vote in January by the Board of Supervisors and ultimately was rejected by a majority of the board. Those who supported it were Sarmiento and Supervisor Katrina Foley, who have both expressed concerns about the accountability for these dollars that Supervisor Doe directed. Supervisor Doe actually left that meeting early, so he was not there for this vote and this debate. But the other two supervisors, Doug Chafee and Don Wagner, voted against the reforms. Wagner said it was unfair to Supervisor Doe for them to pass these rules. He called it unconstitutional, actually, to pass these ethics reforms. And Supervisor Chafee said it may even be better for supervisors to award money to their immediate family, to their children, adult children, because they know, you know, they raise their children, raise them to be ethical. So he didn't see any issue with what Supervisor Doe had done. So, yeah, that reform measure stalled and didn't move forward.
Nick, thank you so much. We'll look forward to your continuing coverage of this. Extraordinary work here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Larry.
We appreciate it. Nick Gerda, LA's senior reporter, Unhoused Communities, his beat. But this investigative story in Orange County has been majority consuming, I'm sure, for him. Last time he was with us, talking about the documents that he went through, just pages and pages and a considerable amount of time. And that's, of course, what it takes to follow a story like this that you're breaking. Nick Gerda, LA's senior reporter. It's Air Talk on LA's 89.3. It's Entertainment Thursday. Let's talk NBA. The Clippers, the Lakers in playoff action this weekend. We'll preview those matchups, talk about the most exciting players who are going to go head-to-head when we come back in 1 minute. It's Air Talk on LA's 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. It's Entertainment Thursday throughout the day at LA's.com and LA's 89.3. Saturday afternoon at 5:30, the Lakers open their series, first round of the NBA Western Conference playoffs. Lakers will be in Denver to play the Nuggets, who finished second in the standings in the Western Conference. The Nuggets have bedeviled the Lakers this season and last. The Lakers were swept out in the Western Conference Finals against the Nuggets last year. The Clippers, who've had a very successful 51-win season, are going to be hosting the Dallas Mavericks in the start of their series on Sunday at 12:30 at Crypto.com Arena. Joining us to talk about the series matchups here and how the teams have played in this 2024 season, from The Athletic, staff writer who covers the Clippers, Law Murray, and Dan Wyke of the LA Times, who's the Lakers beat writer. Dan and Law, thank you both so much for being with us. Dan, let me start with you, because the Lakers have had, in typical Laker fashion, a tremendously dramatic up and down season. LeBron James, so late in his career, still having the ability intermittently to dominate games. Dan, how do you characterize this 2024 regular season for the Lakers?
Exhausting, Larry. I would say, as someone who's been on the ground for all of it, I'd say it's been a very, a lot of whiplash, a lot of drama. You know, this is a team that, it really seemed like had actual championship level, not just goals, but like it seemed possible, right? They won the inaugural NBA in-season tournament, and they did so in pretty dominant fashion. And it kind of made it seem like, hey, when this team needs to really go, it can. And then it played a horrible month of basketball in a way that you started to wonder whether or not they were going to maybe make a coaching change. Do they need to do something more drastic with their roster? And after that, they just sort of rounded into a really good basketball team. They just happened to play in a conference where playing really good basketball meant that you just didn't lose ground. You didn't gain a lot of it. But it's funny, you know, they entered the last weekend of the regular season as the 10 seed in the West. They emerged now seventh in the playoff through two really big wins in New Orleans, one in the play-in game the other night. And they get the team that sort of has vexed them at every step of the way the last couple of years. But, you know, this has been, like, they've had a pretty good season, all things considered, Larry. It's just like the highs have been very high.
Yeah.
The lows have been very low. And now it's sort of, you know, they've been playing their best basketball and in the playoffs. I said this to a coworker yesterday, you know, two of their last three losses, Larry, Anthony Davis has gotten hit in the face in the first quarter and had to leave the game. That goes back like over a month. Like, this team has won a lot of games down the stretch. And you know, if the goal of the regular season is to be playing your best basketball at the end of it, mission accomplished,
yeah,
I guess, for the Lakers. Like, this is as good as they've been. And, you know, the reward for that is the best player in the world in Nikola Jokic, and maybe the best team in the NBA in the Denver Nuggets.
Yeah, and we'll come back and talk a bit about the Nuggets and how they have so vexed the Lakers. But let's talk Clippers with Law Murray, staff writer for The Athletic. He covers the Clippers. Law, thank you so much for joining us. So how would you characterize the Clippers 2023-24 regular season? Law, are you there? Okay.
Well, yes. Yeah. Thank you for having me, Larry. I had to make sure I had unmute this.
Oh, great. Yes.
To speak to you.
Thank
you. Good morning, and great to join you on the show here. And this has been a very interesting year for the Clippers. A lot of pressure because this is an era where this is arguably their last best chance with the team that they've assembled to fulfill what they set out to do 5 years ago when they brought Kawhi Leonard and Paul George onto the roster. And this was a very good regular season for them in the end, but it came with a lot of peaks and valleys. They acquired James Harden, who is another future Hall of Famer, and that put Russell Westbrook, a fourth future Hall of Famer, in the second unit. And that didn't work out initially. They lost their first five games with Harden and part of a six-game losing streak. So they put themselves on a hole early in the season. And the fact that they stabilized from that by the end of November, the fact that they went on a nine-game win streak in December, a start of a run where they went 26-5, that's a significant stretch of any NBA season where they look like the best team in basketball, especially on the offensive end of the floor. That was huge. For them to go through all of those issues early and then come out on the other side of it, that speaks to the staying power that those players have had, but also the culture of the team that's been established over the last several years. And so going into this playoffs, I think they're in a mostly good state. They got to be the home team to start the playoffs against the Dallas Mavericks. And now it's just a question of how healthy is Kawhi, their best player, and whether or not they can fulfill all the things that they've shown that they could be capable of this season, that they've shown over the last several years, that they've had good regular seasons before. Everyone just wants to see the Clippers stay healthy and not leave this postseason with any regrets. And so the first round will establish that right away.
Well, and last year they were so injury riddled going into the playoffs, you didn't see the Clippers as an intact team at that point. But how is Kawhi going into the playoffs? What is his level of health?
That's something that the Clippers do not want us to know. They are preaching optimism. They are suggesting that Kawhi is day to day with a right knee, we'll just call it right knee inflammation. That's what the team said that he missed the last 2 weeks of the regular season with. To my knowledge, he's practicing. He is participating, getting ready, gearing up for Sunday's game one. And I would expect him to play. I do not know just yet. No one's revealing just yet what his level of availability will be, whether he'll be able to play a full complement of minutes, whether he'll be able to gear up for what everyone knows that in the playoffs, you play more minutes, you shorten your rotations. I don't know if that's going to be the case right away to start after Kawhi has had what will ultimately be 3 weeks off. The Clippers have been united in their messaging about not revealing Kawhi's status or how exactly that he's looking, because at this point, the Dallas Mavericks, they would be very interested in knowing what Kawhi Leonard's status is as well as they prepare to come to LA and to start this series. So I think the news, the developments for the most part have been positive, not overwhelmingly so, but it obviously leads to more questions that will be answered throughout Sunday's game.
Well, and even if Kawhi isn't fully available minutes-wise or is constrained because of his knee, wouldn't the Clippers still be a favorite over Dallas in this first round?
Maybe, because it comes down to this. Dallas is playing great basketball. They're entering this postseason with a 16-4 record over the last 20 games, and that's with the last couple of games they punted because they weren't going to pass the Clippers in the standings. The Clippers did win the tiebreaker against the Mavericks 2-1, but the Mavericks made multiple trades to bolster their talent. And the Clippers haven't seen this group of Dallas Mavericks specifically. So I think the way that Dallas has played better, especially on the defensive end, they were the best defense in the league over the last quarter of the season. I think that the Mavericks, even with Kawhi, they have the confidence where they can get over the hump. The Clippers have eliminated the Mavericks twice in the last 5 years, and this is going to be the third round here between these two teams facing each other in the playoffs. I think the motivation and the focus is enough for them. We talked about the Clippers' motivation, this being arguably their last best chance to finally get it done with this group of players. The Mavericks, they're not trying to get eliminated by the same team three times in a five-year span. So I think that the status of Kawhi is absolutely relevant. I don't think that even with Kawhi out there, the Mavericks have a good chance to win this series. They were up 2-0, even with the Clippers having home court advantage back in 2021. So this is as much of a coin flip of any of the eight first round series in the NBA to start the playoffs this year.
We're talking with Law Murray, who's staff writer for The Athletic. He covers the Clippers, as Dan Wyke does for the LA Times, covering the Lakers. And they're joining us to talk about their respective teams that they're reporting on. Dan, let me come back to you and talk about the Nuggets. I mean, they just seem to have manhandled the Lakers for the past 12 months. And, you know, what's the thought within Lakerdom about the team's ability to compete with the Nuggets on the court?
Yeah, it's interesting, Larry. The script has been pretty familiar for these games, which would be Denver looks dominant for a stretch. The Lakers then fight their way back and grab some level of control of the game, only then in crunch time to see the Mavericks basically run the same play over and over and over again, and the Lakers are unable to stop. Right? Like, it is a...
Yeah, and you meant the Nuggets. Let me just interject.
A pressure point that the Denver Nuggets have found on this Lakers defense that the Lakers haven't solved. And it's played out this way in the playoffs last year. It's played out this way a bunch in the regular season this year. And it's funny, when you talk to players on the team privately about this, it's hard to really tell if this is better or worse that they felt close and not been able to figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, on one hand, it feels like if we could only solve this one thing, you know, we're golden. Like, we've got it. You know, we know what we need to address. We know that this is the thing, you know, and basically it's the Jamal Murray, Nikola Jokic pick and roll with shooters around and an athletic player in Aaron Gordon and just kind of the way that Denver picks them apart, right, in these late game situations. Like, if we could just zero in on this, the Lakers thing, you know, we should feel pretty good about where we're at. The problem is like, they knew this, I think, in game one of the Western Conference Finals last year, have had eight chances since then to figure it out and have come up empty each time. And that, I think, is, you know, there's psychological elements to that. There's certainly some frustration. They do, Larry, feel very good about where they're at right now in terms of, you know, the intangible elements. Talked about Kawhi's health, like, the Lakers really don't have any of that right now. You know, Anthony Davis had some back spasms the other day, but, you know, he thinks he'll be 100%. There's really no mystery in this. It's just sort of like, you know, and this is to me the really interesting question is like, can LeBron James, who's maybe the smartest player ever, or certainly one of the smartest players ever to play this game, can he solve like the five-star level Sudoku that is the Denver Nuggets late game offense?
Yeah.
Can he figure it out?
Yeah.
Right. Like, and so far the answer has been no, that, you know, he's torn the book up in frustration, thrown the pencil on the ground and moved on to other things.
Hey, Dan, I need to wrap shortly, but I did want to ask you, you know, Law was talking about, and I think this is a really important point, the Clippers, this is like make or break with this composition of team. They move into their brand new Inglewood Arena next year. So the stakes are really high for the Clippers. What's your sense of what are the stakes for the Lakers?
They're very high too, Law. I'm sorry, Larry. Law's right. I think that the other thing here is, you know, every day that the Lakers move forward with LeBron James, right? Like, they can't be sure he'll be as good tomorrow. He's 39 years old. He's played 21 seasons in the league. The fact that he's still doing things like He established a career high in 3-point field goal percentage this year. In year 21, very much like an old dog, new tricks type of situation, they have to think that this is going to end at some point, and you just don't know when. So every time you get one of these opportunities, and this is a real one, they are healthy. They've played really good basketball. Like, this is a real chance to maximize your time with LeBron James. Those are the stakes for the Lakers more so than do you worry about. I mean, he can be a free agent in the offseason, and we can have that conversation later. But I think it's more so just like you don't know how many real cracks you're going to get with this guy when he's still an all NBA level player. And this is one of them. Like, you've managed to fight off time thus far. So, you know, there's pressure to take advantage of that.
Yeah. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate you being with us. That's Dan Wieke of the LA Times. He covers the Lakers for the Times. Law Murray covers the Clippers for the Athletic, where he's staff writer. And again, the playoffs starting this weekend, the Lakers playing Saturday at 5:30, the Clippers 12:30, Lakers play the Nuggets in Denver, and the Clippers host Dallas at their downtown arena the last year that they're at Crypto.com before they move into their new home in Inglewood. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. TV Talk comes next.
Support for LAist comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting American Mariachi by Jose Cruz Gonzalez. It's the 1970s and women can't be mariachis. Or can they? American Mariachi is a feel-good comedy about familia, amor, and tradición that will send your heart soaring and put a bounce in your step with a wave of vibrant, infectious live music. On stage through June 9th, tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Entertainment Thursday always includes TV Talk, and we're so pleased to be joined by the editor-in-chief at Primetimer, Danette Chavez, and from Deadline, senior editor Dominic Patton. Let's talk first about the NBA playoffs as a TV event, because, of course, live sports have driven so much of rating success and advertising. We're going to be talking with Dominic shortly about what he thinks about the ability of these NBA playoffs to attract significant numbers of viewers. But let's start with Danette on Big Mood, which is a comedy series starring Nicola Coughlan, Lydia West also, and Camilla Whitehill is the creator of the series, which premieres tomorrow on Tubi. Danette, thanks so much. What do you think of Big Mood?
Yeah, I've been describing the show as HBO's Girls if it had been a two-hander. And I just think it's such an apt comparison because it captures the messiness of this chapter in life, you know, like late 20s, early 30s. And there's also just something so distinctly millennial about this dramedy, you know, like characters realizing that technology has actually hindered their ability to connect with people. And just this feeling that you're always going to be playing catch up in your life. Big Mood has a lot of big ideas on its mind, though, from the importance of finding community to highlighting how mental health is a journey, really, a process. It's not a destination. It's not just this place that you get to end up after X number of years or treatments. And it renders them all with really biting humor, which again is what reminds me of Girls, stylish direction. And then you've also just got these two stellar leads. She plays the wallflower with this huge secret in Bridgerton, but Nicola Coughlan has been owning the spotlight since she first appeared in Dairy Girls 6 years ago. She's such an exciting and vivacious performer, and she puts that energy to great use in Big Mood. And Lydia West, who was great in It's a Sin, that HBO limited series from a few years back, she was kind of kept on the sidelines of that show, I think. So it's great to see her have the chance to properly shine in something like Big Mood.
And what's your sense of how they handle the lead character's bipolar disorder? How that is that dealt with in a straightforward way, or how do they handle that?
I think that they're as sensitive as they can be without going full docuseries. You know, like nothing is glamorized or nor is anyone demonized, right? Like it's certainly depicted as a struggle. But, you know, there's also something very unique in how Camilla Whitehill, who is a playwright, depicts the whole thing. It's not enough to ask for help, but it's an important point to make. It's everybody's journey is different with their mental health, but what I appreciated from the show is that, you know, asking for help is just the beginning of the process.
We're talking about the comedic drama Big Mood on the free streaming service Tubi, starring Nicola Coughlan and Lydia West. Camilla Whitehill is the creator of the series. It premieres tomorrow. There will be a total of 6 episodes of Big Mood. Dominic, let's talk about the NBA playoffs as television event, because, of course, for networks and streamers, live sports is the holy grail for them, because it's one of the few places you get significant tune-in to sell ads around. What's the sense of how attractive the NBA playoffs are going to be this season?
I think the NBA playoffs are going to be very attractive, and I say this as an Angelino. We've got both the Lakers and the Clippers in round one, so you're looking at what's the second biggest television market in America is doubling down. So you can ask yourself, last year, in the NBA Finals with the Boston Celtics and the Golden State Warriors, 11.6 million viewers on average. Now, those numbers, if we're of a certain age and you remember, you know, tens of millions watching MASH, don't seem so big. Or even if you look at the Super Bowl where you have 100 million, don't seem so big. But for linear television, those numbers are huge. Last year's playoffs on average, which of course go on for almost 3 months, was 5.47 million. So when you're looking at something like this year, where you're going to have, we're going to already have the Lakers playing tomorrow
Saturday.
The Nuggets. You're going to have the Clippers playing against the Mavericks on Sunday. And of course, this isn't over yet. We still have 2 more teams in the play-ins. We still have the Bulls versus the Miami Heat to see who's going to get the 8th spot in the Eastern Conference. And, of course, we have the Sacramento Kings versus the Pelicans for who's going to get the 8th spot in the Western Conference. My point being is live sports, as you said, Larry, is the holy grail. Add to that the spice of 2 LA teams in the playoffs. Add to that. See, my voice is breaking because I'm so passionate.
It is exciting.
The fact is that these are numbers that matter, and these are things that are going to keep us going for weeks. And also, let's be completely clear, coming off the huge success of the NCAA tournament with the men's, but especially the women's tournament, Caitlin Collins and Reese, let's give a shout out to them. Basketball has got America's attention right now in this election year. So I think this playoffs is going to be something that's going to get many, many people watching because everybody's playing.
Yeah, good point. Dominic Patton joining us, senior editor at Deadline. Let's talk next about Dinner with the Parents, which is streaming on another free platform, Freevee, the series starring Michaela Watkins and Dan Bacadal, the series created by John Beckerman, who adapted this from the British series Friday Night Dinner. Danette, what do you think about the comedy Dinner with the Parents?
Yeah, I hope you don't mind if I draw another comparison, but it reminds me of it makes me think of Curb Your Enthusiasm meets Modern Family. Yeah. It's not a mockumentary, but it combines the same kind of like candid and exceedingly awkward comedy of something like Curb and the original series, right? Friday Night Dinner. But it, you know, takes the edge off with sweeter moments. You know, John Beckerman's background is an American sitcom, so we can kind of expect him to take a bit of the edge off of the British original. But I don't think we have to worry about this becoming, you know, all morals, you know, all like happy lessons. Everybody loves each other, but there are absolutely moments where where you kind of wonder if they don't also hate each other a little bit. What I enjoy most about the show is it captures how conflicted we can feel when we go home. You know, like home is this place of comfort, but it's also for some of us as a side of like, you know, a place of like personal triumphs as much as humiliations, right? Only in Dinner with the Parents, you know, it's not just like your basic childhood trauma or embarrassing mom and dad. Like there are way more heightened scenarios, like someone breaks into their crush's house to retrieve a Valentine that they did not realize was obscene. And in
it's
another
very instance, Curb.
It's very Curb. And then in another instance, someone fakes an illness to keep their dad rock band from breaking up. You know, it's you'll recognize your family, but you'll also be kind of grateful that this isn't your family. And I mean that in the best way. The cast is fantastic. You know, Michaela Watkins, Dan Bacadal, Daniel Thrasher, who's new to TV, but is a YouTube creator, actually looks so much like Dan Bacadal. It's wild. You've got a legend like Carol Kane and Henry Hill. Julia Louis-Dreyfus's son is also really good as the kind of prodigal son.
Dinner with the Parents, streaming on the Freevee platform, premiering today. There'll be a total of 10 episodes of the comedy series. When we come back, we'll be talking with Dominic and Danette about the season finale of Manhunt, streaming on Apple TV Plus. Control-Alt-Desire, which is a documentary miniseries. And Dom will weigh in on the White House Correspondents' Dinner as well. We'll come back in just 1 minute on Air Talk. It's TV Talk with our critics back in 60 seconds. It's TV Talk with Deadline's Dominic Patton and Danette Chavez, editor-in-chief at Primetimer. Next up is the series Manhunt, its season finale. It streams on Apple TV Plus. This, the series that's set in the immediate aftermath of the assassination of President Lincoln, Will Harrison, Tobias Menzies, and Anthony Boyle star Monica Beletsky is the creator of this series. Dominic, your thoughts on how this season ends, Manhunt?
Well, you know, spoiler alert, a lot of people get put on trial for the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. John Wilkes Booth is not one of them, as we saw in the episode that dropped last week on Apple, because he's killed in this. But what's interesting about this that I really want to talk about for Manhunt is this is a show that has kind of fallen under the radar and yet might be one of the most important shows of 2024, in my opinion. It is a show that is very much talking about the times we're living in, both political violence and the great divisions in the country, divisions that many people believe we have not seen since the Civil War, though that's subjective to some degree, obviously. Also, Tobias Menzies is just absolutely outstanding in this. If you loved him in The Crown, if you loved him in other shows, you will find here he is at his top as War Secretary Edward Stanton. And what's interesting about this seven episodes, and with the seventh episode dropping tomorrow, the finale, is this is a complete story, which is not something we actually see that much on television, streaming or linear that much anymore. It is total. There's not really anywhere else to go with this story. So they tell it, and I find what I loved about Manhunt, and again, historical facts are what they are, so you already know how this is going to end. This is, you mentioned Monica, the showrunner and creator of this. This is smart, lean, to-the-point writing. It's the sort of thing that others should watch just for the, people should watch not only for the pleasure of watching the story, but also for the format and the narrative. It's a work of craft. Craft that to be admired.
And it's billed as a season finale. Does that mean, you know, once this concludes with the trial, that there won't be another season, or is the potential for that to happen?
Well, it's hard to have another season, being that the main character, played by Tobias Menzies, Civil War War Secretary Edward Stanton, died about 5 years later, not long after the dust-up with President Johnson, and then when Ulysses S. Grant appointed him to the Supreme Court, he died. But I do think there's a very good, you know, true crime sells in America on the small and big screen. So I do think there's a great possibility for Apple to turn this into a franchise, whether or not it's another presidential assassination, fact being is there were several of them through the last part of the 19th century and obviously into the 20th.
We're talking about Manhunt. Its season finale is releasing tomorrow. It's the seventh episode of Manhunt, streaming on Apple TV+. Control-Alt-Desire is streaming on Paramount+. It's a true crime documentary miniseries directed by Colin Archdeacon. It tells the story of Grant Amato, convicted of murdering his parents and his brother. Danette, what did you think of Control-Alt-Desire?
You know, the churn of true crime has led to a bunch of underdeveloped ideas and overlong projects, but I think this is an example of how personal the genre is becoming. In recent months, we've had docs like Great Photo, Lovely Life, and The Truth About Jim, which have focused on like a personal connection to the subject matter of the documentaries. Colin Archdeacon had no prior connection to Grant Amato, who was convicted of murdering his entire family. But the last hour of Control-Alt-Desire feels very personal. You know, it's, this is his first documentary. He's a longtime director of photography, but this is his first, this is his directorial debut. And, you know, as much as he tries to stay behind the camera, you know, and not become the story, just think about the irony of someone whose last name being Archdeacon getting a confession essentially from, you know, a convicted murderer. And, you know, it's in the final hour of the series, which is a three-parter, and it's out in full now. It's when it really starts to distinguish itself from all the other true crime out there.
Yeah, and the story itself, this involves also an obsessive relationship with an internet cam model. So, I mean, there's a wide range of sort of things it sounds like to explore in the three episodes.
Absolutely. You know, Archdeacon said that that's what drew him to the project, right? Is, you know, examining how, again, you know, technology actually creates a greater distance between people in real life. And, you know, I'm certain that there are some people that will bring up the whole male loneliness epidemic. That kind of felt like well-trod ground to me. That was not the most groundbreaking part of it. For me, what I found most interesting was really seeing a first-time documentary maker, find the line, you know, like walk right up to the line without really crossing it.
Control-Alt-Desire, a three-episode documentary miniseries on Paramount+. And the White House Correspondents' Dinner is airing on C-SPAN as well as on Cable News Channel. It's coming up on April 27th, put on by the White House Correspondents' Association. It raises money for journalism awards and for scholarships. I have to say, Dominic, it's an event that always makes me a little queasy. These people that are covering the White House, they're laughing and, you know, rubbing shoulders with governmental officials in D.C. But, you know, what are your thoughts about this event?
Well, I will say I'm attending it this year, and I've attended it in the past. You know, Saturday Night Live's Colin Jost is going to be the after president speaker, as they say, so expect some degree of mild roasting, probably not as much as Roy Wood Jr. did last year, and certainly less than others have done, but more than some. The president will obviously get up, is expected to get up and give a speech, which will be full of barbs throwing at some of his political and media enemies, as well as probably knowing Joe Biden, some inspirational words about who we are as a country in this year of election. But yes, I mean, I think you're very right, Larry. And of course, there is a huge celebrity portion of this now, which has happened over the past 20 years. You know, last year there were people like, well, SAG-AFTRA President Fran Drescher was there, who we expect to be there this year. This Is Us star Justin Hartley, Lena Headey, who was on Game of Thrones, John Legend was there, Rosario Dawson, many others. There's some of the cast members of Vanderpump Rules were there, Caitlyn Jenner, et cetera, et cetera, and some SNL alum. You know, this has become, people refer to it as Nerd Fest or Nerd Prom, but this is sort of, if you're wondering about a bicoastal elite, I got to tell you, the basement of the Washington Hilton is where they're going to be next Saturday. Having said that, What's interesting about this is as television, because what we're talking about, C-SPAN, of course, have the cameras in there, and they're filming almost everything, and they do it wall to wall, and you actually get to really see some interactions between people, as well as you can learn about the work that journalists are doing around the world and the scholarships that are being handed out. At the same time, others, CNN, MSNBC, even Fox News, all of them are getting there with a feed, and they all have their take on it. So it's a very interesting look at how journalism covers journalism.
I bet you could.
As a journalist,
yeah,
I will say I find that somewhat interesting.
That is interesting. You could flip from channel to channel and see, as you say, the way in which they frame it. Thanks so much. Have a wonderful time at the dinner, Dominic. I'm sure you will. It's a week from Saturday night in D.C., the White House Correspondents' Dinner, the Pure Feed on C-SPAN. Thanks so much to our critics, Danette Chavez, editor-in-chief at Primetimer, and Dominic Patton, senior editor for Deadline. NPR's Here and Now comes up next. I'll be with you tomorrow morning at 10 for Film Week with our critics. And, of course, 9 o'clock, it's Austin Cross hosting the first hour with Air Talk. Have a great day.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.